The Tom Woods Show, episode 1441.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been spreading some pretty terrible ideas, and she's wrong on just about everything. Well, I've put together the definitive smash of all of it. The Green New Deal, affordable housing so-called, free college, high tax rates. It's in another free ebook, yes, a free ebook called AOC is Wrong, The Upside Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Grab your free copy at aociswrong.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here talking to Jeff Dice today. Jeff is the president of the Mises Institute, and he also served as chief of staff to former Congressman Ron Paul. We're talking about so-called woke capitalism. It's where companies feel like they need to let us all know where they stand on controversial or, let's say, on issues of the day, because I am dying to know what my shaving cream company thinks about whatever. I mean, they're answering a question nobody asked. All right, so we're going to examine that phenomenon today. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Tom, it's good to talk to you. It pains me that I will not be on the Contra Cruise. I'm not sure when this episode airs, but presumably just before maybe the Contra Cruise.
It does air indeed just before the Contra Cruise, 2 days before, as a matter of fact. No, 1 or 2 days before.
Okay.
Because it's Friday, July 5th, and we had such a great time with you on board last year. We are definitely going to miss you this year. But if it makes you feel any better, we're going to have an amazing time.
Well, it's a cruise, but you're not a captive on this cruise. I actually liked everybody who was a member of the cruise last year, and we missed them. My wife is wishing we could go, but at any rate, perhaps next year.
Yes, that would be great, and we do have such a wonderful crew of people this year. Okay, so we're talking today about an issue that came up actually in a previous episode with Michael Rechtenwald. Toward the end, he started talking about what's referred to now these days as woke capitalism. Now, first of all, if I may, Jeff, say a word about this word woke. I love how the idea is that being woke means you accept all the culturally expected things of you. Like, so you woke up to what? Accept all the conventional wisdom on everything? Like, see, to me, woke would be being a libertarian and seeing through all of it. You know, so the word is a problem with the word. I'm woke. And now it's woke capitalism, which means you have business firms who, without any direct compulsion by the state, are nevertheless making darn sure we all know where they stand on a variety of issues that really has nothing to do with their products or anything else, but has everything to do with positioning. And I mean, well, we can theorize later about why they do it, where this phenomenon comes from, but that it is a phenomenon is hard to deny. I mean, Nike, I mean, we could just go on down the line of companies engaging in it. So this was actually your idea for us to talk about this. So obviously we can get into specifics right away. What do you think about the overall phenomenon? It seems like it's a relatively recent thing. Like, I don't remember Pepsi in the 1980s telling me anything except if you put us head to head with Coke, you're actually going to surprisingly find you prefer us. That was it. And that was what I expected them to say.
Well, what's interesting here is that we were just coming off of Pride Month, where almost all of the big companies were applying some sort of rainbow flag or having some sort of ad, being involved in Pride Month. It's almost like an arms race, because if other companies are doing it and you don't, let's say you're a brand of beer who doesn't participate with any kind of Pride ad campaign and Budweiser does, then the question becomes, well, are you against Pride? Are you against LGBT folks or LGBT rights? And so it's really an unusual and unique phenomenon, and there's an awful lot of mimicry going on. But here's the thing. I don't think these companies are doing so because of government per se. In other words, I think they're leading. I think we can learn something here from Michael Malice in his book, where he talks about the cathedral and these sort of viewpoints that are coming down from on high, generally in universities. I think that is very much infected corporate America as well. So if we go back to, let's say, the housing bubble of the 2000s, we could say that banks and other mortgage lenders were responding rationally to the Fed, because the Fed was making the cost of borrowing money so cheap that, hey, you might as well just throw out as many loans as you can. And if a lot of them are underperforming and you lose some money, well, you make it up on just volume. And so it was a rational response to a government, well, a quasi-government entity creating an incentive to do something. Whereas here, I don't think companies are doing that. I think they are really leading government in many ways here. And, you know, if you had to have a poster child for this, I'm sure some of your listeners are going to know all about Salesforce. Salesforce is really the 800-pound gorilla in the CRM space. And at the Mises Institute, we use Salesforce, which is a very fine platform for our own fundraising database. And the CEO of Salesforce is a guy named Mark Benioff, and he is an exceedingly woke, outspoken person on LGBT. And he was really a couple years ago at the forefront leading companies to boycott some of these states. I guess North Carolina had an LGBT bathroom type bill a few years ago requiring you to use a certain bathroom or something like that. And so he was sort of out front on that, and to the point where the governor of North Carolina said he's a corporate bully. And I thought that was so interesting because here you've got a Republican governor calling a corporate leader a bully. And of course, there's plenty of hypocrisy to go around. In other words, all of a sudden, Tom, all of our friends on the left are not so worried about corporate power. They think it's just A-OK, and these are private companies just doing what they want to do. What's so astonishing here, though, is you got to hand it to the left. Now, I use the term woke exactly in the opposite way. To me, someone who's woke is someone who's maybe a hoppy and ANCAP who's, you know, really read Rothbard and has sort of had the blinders fall off their eyes, not someone who is spoon-fed a bunch of egalitarian nonsense from, you know, Twitter or wherever they consume it. But yes, when it comes to wokeness, you got to hand it to the left because, in a sense, they really do put the progressive movement ahead of profits. Now, you know, of course, maybe they're calculating that in the long run, this is the best thing to do, you know, for their bottom line. But in the short term, you know, you sometimes have to admit that some of these companies are perhaps alienating part of Trump America or alienating part of Christian America or whatever it might be, whatever the particular issue is. And there's something pretty profound there. That there's, you know, a bottom line ahead of profits. And I think that's something we have to give them credit for and we have to think about. I mean, how do you change the world? Rothbard argued for a multi-pronged approach, and the left is doing just that. They do what they can do legislatively. What they can't do legislatively at the local level, they might do nationally. What they can't do nationally, they might do at the judiciary. What they can't do in court, they might do at the corporate level. So it's really, it's a full court press. And I would say generally it's working. I think the left has won the culture wars. And I think that that is now evidenced in corporate America. I don't think there's any question about it, Tom.
So you think, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but you think these companies are sincere or opportunistic or what?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. I think they take a cold, hard look at the way things are going and they say, look, you know, it's even if we're going to alienate a few customers now, in 10 or 20 or 50 years, it's far better to not be the company that everyone's looking back on and saying, oh my gosh, they were, you know, like Volkswagen's involvement in World War II or something like that. We tend to think in terms of time preference, and we criticize bad economic policies and bad political policies and democracy generally for producing a high time preference mindset. But wow, here we are looking at the left and they're playing the long game on us, aren't they? I mean, they're perfectly willing in some ways to do tough work today to gain victories that might come beyond their own lifetimes or at least beyond the next election cycle. So as I said, you got to hand it to them in that sense. I think there's a very strong sense amongst millennials that you don't separate life into personal and professional and religious, you know, that everything is all kind of blended together in one. You want your companies to reflect your work, to reflect your education, and there's not these distinctions that maybe you and I grew up with where your parents said, oh, you know, never talk about religion or politics or sex to a stranger. You know, well, that all those old prescriptions seem to be falling away, and now everything is utterly politicized. It's almost shocking. And of course, social media amplifies and intensifies this and makes everything so immediate and so harsh. You know, just in the last couple of days, we've seen this thing with Colin Kaepernick, who has been involved with Nike as a spokesman. And let me just say, I didn't mind the Colin Kaepernick take a knee protest. I don't really care about the national anthem, and I don't really care about flag waving, and I especially don't like military stuff at football games. And so I thought the take a knee protest was subtle. I thought it was understated. It wasn't in your face or aggressive. It was kind of like the Vietnam Wall versus the World War II memorial. You know, it was quiet. And now I'm a little offended by, I think that the notion that America is a deeply racist country, I think that's nonsense. And I think that's just not true. I think America is one of the least racist places in the world. And maybe not the least, but among the least. But nonetheless, Colin Kaepernick thought he was standing up for black folks who have been abused by cops, and he takes a knee. I think that's fine. Now, the question becomes, should Nike embrace this, or should Nike steer clear of this in a spokesman? Well, you know, Phil Knight and other people at Nike decided to embrace it. And ultimately took him on, kept him as a spokesman, and presumably paid him sponsorship fees during some years where he was not making an NFL salary, I might add. So that's very interesting to me. But now we find out that Nike was prepared to produce a new shoe with the Betsy Ross flag sewn on the back of it, on the heel or something like that, which is interesting. It'd be funny if they had to sew the flag of the country it was made. You know, we'd all be walking around with clothes that had Bangladeshi and Vietnamese flags on them. But nonetheless, they were going to make this shoe with the Betsy Ross flag, which, by the way, violates the flag code. Some of you might know 4 USC Section 8 in the 1940s during World War II was passed into law. You're not supposed to have flags on your clothing. But it's not enforced. And so Colin Kaepernick somehow persuades Nike not to produce this shoe. Now, that's fascinating to me. This is a couple years after the Take a Knee controversy, because even the Betsy Ross American flag now represents some sort of Americanism which offends him or potentially offends people with whom he agrees. Now, this is amazing to me, because now we're talking about the next level of wokeness. We're talking about the American flag, the garden variety stars and stripes American flag, almost being downgraded to the point of like the Confederate flag, which of course has all kinds of connotations to the Civil War, and black people don't like it. A lot of people who aren't black don't like it. And so this is really interesting to me, because now we've reached the point where, you know, it used to be American history prior to the Civil War is null and void because of slavery. Well, now, you know, the next revolution, all that is American history prior to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is null and void. You know, so now what's next? I mean, if we can't have American flags on a shoe, and the fact that a company like Nike, I mean, we're not talking about some minor company here. We're not talking about a pillow manufacturer who advertises on Sean Hannity's show. We're talking about an iconic American brand. I mean, Nike is up there with Levi's and Harley Davidson and Coca-Cola. And yet they have taken a side on this. And there's going to be a lot of right-wing sort of yeehawism over the next 2 days, 3 days, whatever, however short the news cycle is now, before we forget everything and rush to the next thing, where a lot of people on the right are going to say, screw you, Nike. I'm never buying another pair of Nikes. I embrace the flag. The American flag is a symbol of greatness, and we saved the world in World War II and yada, yada, yada. I mean, what kind of business practice is this? This the only way you can explain this and Nike's decision, well, there's two ways. One is that they're just ideologically aligned with Kaepernick, and they agree with him and damn the consequences. But the other is that we're really experiencing a profound shift, where Nike is actually understanding and gauging the future correctly and going with it. So this is all happening so quickly. It's just not the America that we all thought we knew 5 years ago or 10 years ago. That's what strikes me, is the pace of it all.
And for me, as just an ordinary observer, the point that comes through is one that you've made before, that for the left, politics really is everything. There isn't a part of life where you can be shielded from it. It follows you everywhere, because, as you've kind of implied, it's inseparable, because we're all bundled together. It's not like we have some political views, but then we also have our aesthetics and things we do for enjoyment. We have to be making political statements pretty much all the time. So when I had Gary Chartier on recently, I said that when people tell me I should boycott a particular firm because of X or Y, well, most of the time I don't like X or Y. And yeah, I wish that company wasn't doing that. But even though I don't like X or Y, generally, my instinct is I don't want to boycott them because I don't want to spend the rest of my life investigating every single transaction I engage in. What kind of life is that?
Well, even if I was a big flag guy, I have a sweet pair of Nikes that my wife got me for Christmas, and I'm not giving those babies up, especially on a long 12-hour flight. But I mean, here's the thing is, I really like what you said in your interview with Chartier. You don't really believe in these boycotts. You know, Murray Rothbard does have a section about boycotts in The Ethics of Liberty. It's very short. And he sort of goes through, you know, why boycotts are acceptable under libertarian law with the possible exception. Of course, he's showing the era, you know, boycotts now are online, they're digital. But he does talk about pickets. And he questions whether, you know, a picket's happening on, let's say, a government street, and it might be blocking some private landowners. And so it raises some questions that might challenge libertarian law. But in general, he says, no, boycotts are fine. And even though they do harm potentially to the boycotted company, they are a form, an expression of property rights. You have your own property, your own money, and, you know, you should be able to use it as you see fit. But I mean, we can take it to the point, and this has come up recently in music, and this always kills me. You know, Taylor Swift, who's very popular, I know very little about her other than through my daughter, but, you know, she had been kind of criticized because she has a very kind of country look, and her parents apparently were somewhat wealthy and connected and helped her gain a toehold in the music industry and other things. And she had never been very political in her songs. So I don't know why a bubblegum pop singer that 10-year-old girls like my daughter like is supposed to be political. But this is, again, the world we live in. And so now she's come out with some new song that is all about gay rights. And of course, it's still not satisfying her woke critics. Oh, it's too little, too late. So in that sense, it's not working for her. And that's what strikes me is you can, no matter what you do, there's so many landmines out there. And some of us who, I'm a little older than you, Tom, but some of us really grew up in with 80s music and Morrissey and the Smiths. And of course, Morrissey has been in the news quite a bit lately. People are just absolutely savaging him and saying, I don't know if I can listen to his music anymore. And the reason for this is, well, for one, he supported Brexit, said some good things about Brexit. So did Johnny Lydon, by the way, I might add. But more recently, I guess he was on the Jimmy Fallon show performing, and he had a pin on for what the media calls is a far-right British political party. Of course, it turns out these far-right parties, so-called in Europe, are actually for all kinds of trade restrictions and generous welfare benefits and early retirements and all kinds of things. What makes them far-right is that they suggest any limits on immigration. That's what far-right means. So he's given some interviews and said some things lately that are actually causing his fans. Now, this is a guy with a catalog. I mean, Morrissey is a big deal in the UK. He's a big deal in America. But in the UK, I mean, he's approaching, he's iconic, no question about it. And so for all of these people to be sort of hand-wringing and say, well, you know, can I listen to his music anymore? I mean, I even read Nick Cave, who's someone I admire very much, saying, well, we have to separate the musician from his music. And, you know, once you launch that song onto the airwaves, you sort of give up ownership of it, and the people who are listening to it own it themselves. And, you know, Morrissey has these reprehensible views, again, with the tone, you know, quote unquote, what everyone knows. Well, everyone doesn't know that Morrissey disagrees. And so Nick Cave has the audacity to say, well, maybe we should let Morrissey have his retrograde political views and separate the music. Well, you know, thanks very much for allowing someone to have his political views. That's awfully benevolent of you. But, you know, it's just so silly. And how far are you going to extend this? I mean, especially if someone considers themselves a libertarian. I mean, look, you're in a minority movement. There's not that many people who agree with you lock, stock, and barrel. And if you're only going to do business, you know, with people who understand that the state is evil, good luck with that root canal or something next time is all I have to say.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, let's take a quick minute to say a word about good capitalism, because in this day and age, thanks to technology, from the comfort of your home, you can learn a countless array of skills that can help you get better in a hobby that you're pursuing, skills that can help make you a more indispensable employee, so when the pink slips come, you'll be exempt, or skills that can help you build your own side business or even a full-time business, and that's through Skillshare. Skillshare is like the Netflix of online learning. One membership gets you access to over 29,000 classes in all kinds of areas: business, technology, design, illustration, writing, photography, entrepreneurship, you name it. At the very least, you got to go and check it out, explore, see what's there. You're going to be hooked. You can start learning alongside the millions of people who are already enrolled at Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right. You get access to over 29,000 classes for free for 2 months. So go right now to get that 2 months for yourself. The link is skillshare.com/woodsfree. That's skillshare.com/woodsfree. Now, this is not directly related to woke capitalism, but it's, you know, it bears a family resemblance, let's say. I sent out, as we're recording this, it's the same day, I sent out to my email newsletter list a very interesting item that I got from Bob Murphy. Bob sends me email fodder sometimes, and 9 times out of 10, I don't use it because it's I can't comment on it in an amusing enough way. But this time, the man and the article had met because, and incidentally, you should get on my email list. I'm always badgering people, but I just released a brand new ebook called AOC is Wrong, and it's all about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It goes through every single position she has. Like, if you're really sure you could debate free college and healthcare with your neighbors, then you don't need it. But all her stuff, the Green New Deal, it's all in there. So you can get on my email list by going to aociswrong.com. Plus, won't it give you satisfaction to type in aociswrong.com? How can you not do that? I don't know. But anyway, I sent to my email newsletter people a note about an article, a scholarly article written by a professor at Columbia University. And it's called, "Does Apologizing Work? An Empirical Test of the Conventional Wisdom." Now, he's not talking about individuals apologizing to each other for wrongs committed, but he's talking about the ritual apology that we all know. You say something forbidden, and the guardians of allowable opinion begin the ritual, right? You need to do expiation for your sin, and that needs to come in the form of public breastfeeding and apologizing. We all know it. We've all seen this happen many times. So he did an empirical investigation of how well that works. And here's what he found. These are his words. "Overall, the evidence suggests that when a prominent figure apologizes for a controversial statement, the public is either unaffected or becomes more likely to desire that the individual be punished." How about that? It turns out that the old strategy of apologizing and groveling actually makes the situation worse for you. Maybe there's a lesson here from Trump, who apologized only once that I can see. But I just found that a fascinating phenomenon, because all the woke capitalist institutions out there and all the woke activists, they're the ones demanding people's heads when they say the wrong thing. And it turns out if you just ignore them, you wind up doing better in the polls than if you acknowledge them and apologized.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because very few of us are bullies in our real lives, in our corporeal lives. But a lot of people are bullies online and using social media, especially if you're anonymous, using social media. So that's actually very interesting. And it also shows how groupthink overtakes us, that we act like hyenas sometimes online. And we sniff weakness, we sense weakness in someone. And when they start backpedaling, it just doesn't work. And of course, this is what people wanted. This is what they've at least appear to want, is the politicization of everything. And that's what this means. It means that every statement, every utterance, every joke, every comedy act, every movie, every TV show, every song, every singer has to be scrutinized through this lens. I mean, is there anything more exhausting, Tom? I mean, that, we actually have conservative and liberal food chains now. You know, Chick-fil-A is a right-wing proprietor. You know, it's a political act to go to Chick-fil-A or to boycott Chick-fil-A. I mean, I just, you know, it's preposterous. And what's so dangerous about all this, and what I hate about this, is that markets are what bring us together. You know, markets are the real communitarianism. Like, let's say some guy is a redneck, Trump, anti-immigrant, xenophobe who thinks there's too many Mexicans and too many illegals in the United States. Okay. And he goes into a Mexican restaurant in a small town owned by some Mexicans. There might be some people working in the back who aren't fully documented, whatever. He sits down. He enjoys his meal. He pays for it. He says goodbye, nods to the proprietor, and leaves. Everyone's happy. It was just a win-win transaction. And so nobody has to yell at each other or worry about politics for that moment, even though that guy might, you know, think badly of Mexicans. But nonetheless, he goes and enjoys their food and pays for it peaceably. I mean, that's a tiny example of what markets do a billion times over every day. You know, people have a hard time being angry at their customers and at their suppliers. And so it's just amazing to me that what's seeping down into the marketplace, what ought to be an exercise in fulfilling people's needs every day, is now got to be this virtue signaling exercise. And I mean, the pride thing, you know, was really pretty astonishing how many companies just were involved, the degree to which they had to be involved or felt they had to be involved, the marketing campaigns. I mean, this is now part of the landscape, and it's something that came up really quick in the corporate world. I mean, a couple of years ago, they were still probably cautious and wondering about all this. So it just shows you the power of the cathedral. It's real. And it also shows you that we have to understand economics in a subjective manner. We can't, you know, Homo economicus was wrong. It was never right. The Austrians never argued that way. And I always said that people get up every day and they make all kinds of decisions for all kinds of rational or irrational reasons. And so that's why we can't model out what they're going to do. And we can't always know that the marketplace is just going to be this relentless march of selfishness every day. Well, there actually are some people who wake up and in a sense, give up a little bit of economic value and don't buy Nikes because they're mad about this flag thing, or they don't eat Chick-fil-A because they're mad that some Chick-fil-A CEO is anti-abortion. I mean, there is a little bit of an economic diminution there in your life if you actually want the Nikes or actually like the chicken sandwich. But yet people forego that. So that's a different kind of want satisfaction. It fits perfectly with economic theory. And so it's a little surprising. So, you know, to circle back to your original question, you know, where is this coming from? Why are they doing it? Are they really doing it because they're politically woke and they want to have the moral high side? Or is it a cynical attempt to just fit in and make more money as a result of being an approved company? And this and that. Well, you know, it's a lot of things. It's probably a little bit of both. And some of these companies are quite large. They got thousands and thousands of employees, tens of thousands of employees. So they're not monolithic, and there's different voices within there. And there's somebody driving the ship. You know, there's somebody making the decisions at the corporate level, and especially at the marketing level, to do all this. And that's why, you know, I get a little bit exasperated sometimes when I hear about the Kochs or someone like this. It's like, look, Trump is not on the right from my perspective, but he's certainly not on the left. But the idea that the left doesn't hold power in this country, and a lot of left libertarians say that, I just don't buy it. The left controls virtually all universities in the country. The left controls mainline religions. The left controls corporate boardrooms. I mean, we've certainly seen that during Pride Week. Now, that might go more to culture than economics. I get the distinction here, but it's real. And there are certainly people who are being very, very quiet who work at places like Google, like Twitter, and I'm sure at places like Salesforce, and towing the company line because their paycheck's attached to it. So, it's just funny to see all this shake out, because for years and years and years, we were told, well, corporate power is just as important as government power. Okay, but look, when it comes to all of this, when it comes to all this woke capitalism, there's no libertarian view per se on any of this. We can deplore it. The only thing a libertarian has to say is, look, I don't want any state action. I don't want government censoring. I don't want government using antitrust to break companies up. I don't want government seizing companies. And that's it. But beyond that, there's no libertarian view per se. I mean, I think Google's pretty evil. I mean, I've tested this, you know, literally when you go to Google search engine and you type in Joe Biden, and then, you know, all the prompts come up, Joe Biden, Obama vice president, Joe Biden, 2020, Joe Biden, this and that. But when you start to type in, you know, and I'm joking here about like his inappropriate touching or something, none of the prompts autofill. I mean, this isn't in my imagination. I mean, they're actually doing this. Google is actually suppressing searches about Joe Biden rubbing little girls' shoulders and stuff, you know? So, I mean, this is real. These companies aren't my friend. They're not trying to help me create a world with, that shares my worldview. They're not trying to help me create what I think would be a freer world. I mean, this is true, and we can deplore that. And we can rail against that. And I don't want to hear our friends on the left all of a sudden saying, Jeff, these are private companies. They can do what they want with their own property. Okay, please don't tell me that if you're on the left, because that's not what you believe.
Yeah, so that's, first of all, it's good to point out the hypocritical nature of it. But also, what an uninteresting thing to say. So in other words, a libertarian, now I know not qua libertarian, but as a human being, what, isn't entitled to an opinion on what, pretty much anything? Because if I were to criticize anything anybody said, what am I, are they going to accuse me of being against freedom of speech? No, fine, say what you want to say, but I'm allowed to criticize it. Likewise, yeah, have whatever business practice you want, but there's no reason I can't, what reason would there be for me not to be able to criticize that? I mean, think back to the desegregation of lunch counters. That was on private property. And you didn't have people going around saying, well, it's a private company and they can do whatever they want. No, they said, I don't approve of what this private company is doing. So that's all we're doing. We're just saying we don't approve of what this private company is doing. So I'm glad you raised that, because that is the low IQ response to any discussion like this. It's a private company. Like we didn't know that. I mean, I just can't get over somebody whose entire contribution to the conversation is that.
Well, let's not forget, if you know tech geeks, if you have tech geeks in your life and they're over 40, let's say, I mean, the whole promise of the digital age, of the internet revolution, was mass decentralization. And now, remember websites in the 90s? Remember going to antiwar.com in the 90s? I do. I mean, that was really interesting and exciting. That was independent. But now you fast forward and we've got three or four gatekeepers, totally centralized gatekeepers, Twitter, Facebook, Google, for example, absolutely. I won't say controlling what you see online, but certainly steering it. I mean, there's no question about that Twitter and social media steer the conversation. I mean, come on, that's not even debatable. And so that's what's so interesting to me, is that whatever happened to the decentralized revolution, whatever happened to the promise of just being able to have no gatekeepers and do an end run around the would-be self-appointed gatekeepers of public opinion. You know, this is peer-to-peer. We're talking to each other. We can even talk to somebody in China and compare notes on what our governments are doing. That was one of the great promises of the internet. So I think there's a lot to be said for opposing these tech giants to the extent they're illiberal. And I would argue that they are pretty illiberal. I know you've done other shows on deplatforming and social media and legal approaches that might work in a libertarian political sphere and all that. I mean, that's sort of a separate question. But there's certainly nothing wrong with saying, I think Google firing James Damore because he questioned things in a memo about, whether men or women are better at math or whatever it was. I mean, that's pretty unconscionable. Whether they have the legal right to do that's a separate question.
All right, let's. I'll let you go there. Of course, people. I can't imagine there could be somebody listening to my show who doesn't know about the Mises Institute. But there was somebody on my email newsletter list who had not heard of antiwar.com until I mentioned the passing of Justin Raimondo. So I don't want to assume anything. If you haven't visited the Mises Institute's website, it's just going to knock your socks off. And while you're there, make a donation, mises.org. Jeff is the president. A lot of great things are happening there. I credit the Mises Institute. Now, you can decide for yourselves whether this is a good or a bad thing with making me the person I am today. So definitely check out mises.org. And Jeff, thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
All right, folks. Here's an important thing. Tomorrow, at least if you're listening to these as they come out, tomorrow is Independence Day. And I've decided I'm going to take tomorrow off. And the reason is, most of you know, I, along with Bob Murphy, host the Contra Cruise, which is an annual cruise we've done for a week that sort of is in tandem with our podcast, Contra Krugman. And that is starting up this Friday, July 5th, and it is just a nut house around here. So I'm going to take the Independence Day off for my mental health sake, There are 1,444 other episodes you can listen to in the meantime. You can listen to Contra Krugman in the meantime. Plenty of stuff to keep you busy, but that's what I'm going to be doing. And also, make sure you go get, I'm telling you, this thing's great. I wrote an ebook smashing all the arguments of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So it's AOC is Wrong is the name of the book, and you can download it for free at aociswrong.com. And again, isn't that just going to give you pleasure to type in aociswrong.com? And as you're doing it, of course, you can think, boy, that Woods, he sure comes up with good domain names. You're darn right. And in fact, I got that domain name even before they started calling her AOC. They didn't call her AOC from the beginning, but it was, I didn't know what else to do. I mean, Ocasio-Cortez is too long, and Cortez is not her name. So I didn't know what to do. So I just thought, all right, I guess I'll have to do AOC. And then, thank heavens, people started calling her AOC. Oh my gosh, it's like I planned this. So this I did not plan. It just fell into my lap. So aociswrong.com is your homework assignment, and I will be back with you on Friday.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.